Who support this NPR station.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, the Tampa Bay Times is out with its list of best restaurants in the Tampa Bay area. And we'll talk with the Times food critic later on in this program. And we're going to talk about a project that's designed to protect the quality of information on Wikipedia, a project that involves a USF professor and her students. Unfortunately, part of the station's computer system crashed overnight. We won't be able to play back the listener comments about yesterday's program. There were some good ones. Hopefully, our engineers will be able to fix the problem before the hour is over. A lot of people rely on Wikipedia for basic information of all kinds, history, science, culture. But how reliable is Wikipedia? And what's being done to make sure that the Wikipedia entries are accurate? We're joined now by three people who are doing just that. Frank Schulenberg is Executive Director of Wiki Education, and he joins us right now on the phone. Frank, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks
Frank.
Thanks
for having me.
And also here is Laura Runge. She's a professor of English at the University of South Florida. Runge conducted a class titled Jane Austen Bits to Bytes, the graduate course in the fall of 2017, where her students edited Wikipedia pages related to Jane Austen. And also here is one of her students, Elizabeth Ricketts. So Laura and Elizabeth, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming on. So Frank, let me start with you. I think, you know, I've heard that a lot of professors, a lot of high school teachers say, don't use Wikipedia as your first source. You know, you really should find a better source. How reliable would you say is Wikipedia? And is it common for professors to say that, or am I off track?
Well, Wikipedia's reliability and accuracy have improved dramatically over the last couple of years. On the other hand, there are areas on Wikipedia that are not as fully developed as other areas. So Wiki Education is a nonprofit that is dedicated to systematically improving content on Wikipedia, and we're targeting those areas that are not as developed as others.
When you say not as developed, what areas do you mean? Are these the areas where you see under the footnote more information needed or a link needed? Sometimes you see that on Wikipedia?
Yeah, no, it's like areas. You have to see that the differences in coverage on Wikipedia has to do with Wikipedia's demographic of authors. So some people might already know that 90% of Wikipedia's editing community is male, white, well-educated, and some are in their 20s or 30s. And so if you look at that editing community, then you will see that those people write more about topics that they're specifically interested in. And so there are a couple of areas, like, for example, military history, sports, computer games, that are extremely well-developed on Wikipedia, whereas others, if you go to science, for example, there are things that are missing. And we're trying to fill those gaps and to eliminate inaccuracies. And we're supporting professors who use Wikipedia as a teaching tool in their classes.
All right. Well, let's bring Laura Runge and Elizabeth Ricketts onto this discussion. Laura, you're a professor of English at the University of South Florida, and I take it you teach Jane Austen there at USF.
I do. I've taught Jane Austen on the undergraduate level, and most recently, I taught graduate level for the first time.
So we're talking about books like *Sense and Sensibility* and *Pride and Prejudice* and *Mansfield Park* and.
Absolutely, you know your author. That's right.
Well, I had to.
*Northanger Abbey* and *Persuasion* and *Emma*.
Uh huh. So, when you look at as a professor, how do you view Wikipedia? Is it reliable for you? I mean, if I were to ask you that question 5 years ago, Would you say that Wikipedia is a reliable place to start to do research if you're a college student?
5 years ago, no, I would not have. And to address the earlier question just briefly, I think that the perception of Wikipedia as an unreliable source of information is still fairly widespread in academia and in the K through 12 particularly. But it's changing because the process of how the knowledge is made is becoming more well known. And once people like myself, once I realized that the encyclopedia articles are not just written by any random person and they just don't stand there unregarded, you know, for people to put out outrageous things, I have become much more of a believer in using Wikipedia, not necessarily for research, because I wouldn't recommend encyclopedias for research in general, but they're great for information to get you started, to give you a base, and to point you in directions where you can actually do more research.
And when you say that, I mean, that's where the footnotes come in. The footnotes on Wikipedia are so important to go to more primary source information, right?
That's absolutely correct. And I think one of the areas of editing we can really emphasize in the undergraduate classroom and the graduate classroom is cleaning up those citations, because it not only does it do a service for the encyclopedia itself, but it does a service for teaching the students how to evaluate what real information is. And in this day and age, that's super, super important.
Well, let's bring on Elizabeth Ricketts. Elizabeth, you're a student there at USF, and you're taking classes from Laura Runge in English. And I read here that you revised the Sense and Sensibility page on Wikipedia. You must have read Sense and Sensibility a few times.
Yes. I've actually read it several times, and I'm also available on the movie adaptation. That was also really good. But I probably had read it in a class probably twice in undergraduate and once in graduate school. So I was very familiar with the novel.
So when you went to the Wikipedia page for Sense and Sensibility, what did you find about the quality of the information on the page?
The quality was mostly very good, and it was actually one of the higher rated pages. But as in Dr. Runge's class, we talked about even the pages that have a higher rating could have a lot of work to do. So one thing that I noticed was that a lot of the character development and character motivations were not quite fleshed out. So I worked on kind of explaining that a little bit more. And I also noticed the critical views section was very sorely lacking. As a literary scholar, I'm very invested in strong literary scholarship. And the critical views section had cited one scholar, but they also cited information from a self-publishing website where somebody had written a paragraph about Sense and Sensibility. So that's where I could take my experience as a literary scholar and take that information out, because all sources are not created equal, and the person doing the page or doing that section may have thought that that was valid information because it was from a place, but just because you can find it somewhere doesn't mean you can necessarily include it.
Well, when you bring up self-published, I mean, then I've got to ask the question, how do we rely on the editors of Wikipedia? How do we know who the editors are at Wikipedia? And Frank, maybe I should toss that question back to you, because that would seem to be a key bit of information. If somebody is self-published and the book or the scholarly work hasn't been reviewed, I would take that less seriously than a book that's been published by a big publisher or has been published in an academic journal and then reviewed by the scholars who run the journal.
Yeah, everything that is on Wikipedia has to be backed up by sources. So unlike a traditional encyclopedia, it's not so much about like who adds that information, that new information to a Wikipedia article. It's more about, does that person have a reliable source that backs that information up?
I see. So, Elizabeth, to your point, when you saw that it was self-published, why was that a red flag for you, some of this information on the Sense and Sensibility page?
Well, I'd actually like to clarify. It was self-publishing, but it was actually a website not even about sense and sensibility. It was a website on how to self-publish. So the reason why that set off such a red flag for me was that was not a literary scholar. That was somebody giving instructions to people on how to self-publish things that just so happened to have a paragraph about sense and sensibility. So it was setting off multiple red flags that it wasn't a scholar that had been peer-reviewed. It wasn't even a scholar or a writer who was necessarily having anything to do with the subject itself. They just kind of included the information. So that's why the red flag really went off.
Laura, let me bring you back in on this then. So how many professors around the country are engaged in this kind of work, getting their students and indeed themselves to edit pages on Wikipedia? How big is this movement?
That's a question that, in terms of numbers or data, I don't have the answer at my fingertips, but I can give you anecdotal information. When I started doing it, my colleagues were very surprised. But I actually do a bit of advocacy, too, through conferencing and presenting. And most times when I do that, the light bulb goes off because the faculty has realized that this is actually a wonderful teaching tool. And the other aspect that has made my colleagues sort of excited about the idea of becoming a Wikipedia editor is the idea that we are actually responsible to our subjects. So I teach early modern women, and as Frank said, the women editors and are much, much smaller in number than the male editors. And as a result, the subjects that are covered tend not to include things like early modern women. There's a group called Women in Red, which was formed in 2013, whose job it is to advocate and motivate the writing of biographies of women in history. And we work with them, and I've worked with several organizations to do edit-a-thons where we actually teach people how to edit and encourage them to use their expertise to create new pages for example, with early modern women writers, or to go to the ones that exist and evaluate them for gaps in knowledge, or to flesh them out, to create a fuller encyclopedia entry on them. And frankly, the people who care about their subjects are pretty convinced when I tell them that we owe it to our subjects to be represented on what is probably one of the top 10 visited websites in the world. And the number of visitors that are going to read about our subjects on Wikipedia so far dwarfs what we get through our scholarship that they begin to be compelled. So I think the movement is it's moving in the positive direction. People are starting to do this.
Well, that's Laura Runge, who's a professor of English at the University of South Florida in Tampa. And also here is Elizabeth Ricketts. And Elizabeth is a student at the University of South Florida. She has revised the Sense and Sensibility page on Wikipedia. And Laura has had a graduate course where students edited Wikipedia pages related to Jane Austen. Also here is Frank Schulenberg, Executive Director of Wiki Education. Wiki Education's program makes updating Wikipedia a classroom assignment for more than 6,000 university students across the country. And he says this enables students to play an active role in enhancing the world's largest open learning platform and build their information literacy skills at a time when the world is desperately seeking the truth. Frank, who is eligible to edit a Wikipedia entry?
Everybody is. You could go online now and you could start right away.
So is there potential, though, for people who want to spin things and get away from maybe objective facts and spin things? Let's say you get into a description of a religion or description of a political party or a description of a politician. Isn't there potential for people to, wreak havoc on that page and put up all sorts of things that are not true or not fact-based?
Sure, that's always the case in an open system. But what's the beauty is about Wikipedia's approach is there is a large community of longtime Wikipedia editors, and they have certain software mechanisms like a watch list, for example, where things when people edit Wikipedia articles that you're monitoring, then you get a notification. And so there is a lot of control through the large community that Wikipedia has. And I think there is, like, at some point, a couple of years ago, there was, like, a study that showed that if someone vandalizes an article, injects some false information, that on average that information gets removed within the first 5 to 10 minutes.
Well, you need a lot of editors. I mean, Wikipedia is so big, it must have millions of entries. You need tens of thousands of editors.
No, that's correct. That's correct. And Wikipedia is an international project. So besides the English Wikipedia, you have Wikipedia language editions in more than 200 languages. And I think, and to be honest, like, I've been a Wikipedia editor in my free time since 2005, and it's a lot of fun. It's just, you can learn so much about the topic that you're writing about. And I think that's what is, like, the fascinating thing for the students. It's not only they get a deeper learning experience by engaging in this Wikipedia assignment. It also feels like, wow, I'm doing something for other people, right? Like, I'm not writing a term paper that ends up in some drawer and no one really is interested in that. No, you write a Wikipedia article and millions of people have suddenly access to the information that you put on Wikipedia. And I think that's very fulfilling.
So if I see something on Wikipedia, so let's say something I know about firsthand or I've had experience with, and I think the entry is wrong or needs to be expanded, I could put an entry there. I could write that entry, and then one of the Wikipedia editors would edit that entry and either accept or reject it or change it to what their standards are.
Can I jump in and,
yeah, please,
and
please.
Reply to that? Because I have a couple of things I wanted to add. First is to go back to the question of numbers. When I did my presentation in November, the number of registered users, that is Wikipedia editors, was about 32 million.
Whoa.
And the active users, the active editors, are 131,000. So there are hundreds of thousands of people working on this at any time. Now, the thing about that we haven't talked about is the back end of these articles. It's all open, but you have to look at the top page to see what the editors are actually considering as important information and for the validating process. You can look at the top page for any article and find out how the editors are viewing things that might be suspicious or might be not appropriate. And it's a community that talks to each other about what knowledge is supposed to be in that article. So it's not just a random person coming in and spamming. It's actually part of the process to negotiate what is fair. And there are standards that most Wikipedians learn right when they start that we all try to abide by.
Mm. Elizabeth, what did your high school teachers tell you about Wikipedia?
You know, it's funny that you should ask that because I also spent 10 years teaching in the public school system. So not only did I hear, don't use Wikipedia, I also spread the message, don't use Wikipedia. But now as a PhD student and instructor of freshmen and sophomores in literature and composition courses, I've changed my tune. I do not allow them to cite it in a paper. As Dr. Runge said before, you wouldn't cite the encyclopedia anyway, but I especially direct them to those footnotes to find the primary sources and also to just get great background information on the subject. For example, I teach a lot of texts that are out of their time period, such as Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift from the 18th century. So I actually tell them, check out the Wikipedia page on Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels, get yourself familiarized, get yourself some background, and I've definitely changed my tune on that.
Mm. Frank, you're with Wiki Education. Is that part of Wikipedia? And could you tell me, is Wikipedia a nonprofit?
Wikipedia is run and operated by the Wikimedia Foundation, and we're an independent organization. We're also based in San Francisco. And going back to one of your earlier questions about, like, how many teachers are doing this, right? It's we've been working with 500 universities all over the United States and Canada, and it's a growing movement. I think that more and more university instructors see the benefits of, like, improved media literacy that their students get through this Wikipedia assignment, or, like, better writing and research skills. And I think, to be honest, I think it's really important to also take into account that things like media literacy are increasingly important. If you look at, like, how the world of how people change the way they're using information, so many people use the Internet. They Google something, and then Wikipedia entries are almost always among the first 10 search results that you get back from Google. And I think it's really, really important that if that's what's happening and people are using Wikipedia anyway, that there is an organization that is dedicated to making sure that the information that people get on Wikipedia is accurate and not misleading.
And Frank, if people want to get in touch with you, and maybe a college professor is listening right now and want to get their students involved in a project editing Wikipedia pages, how can they get in touch with Wiki Education?
You can go to our website. It's wikiedu.org, and you're going to find all the information that you need to get started.
And Laura Runge at the University of South Florida, do you have a next project? Are you done with Jane Austen, or will you continue to work on Jane Austen for the foreseeable future?
I can never be done with Jane Austen. She won't leave me. No, I work on early modern women in general, sort of going back to Afrobin in the 17th century through Jane Austen. She's sort of my end point. And I am looking into doing more digital humanities work around Jane Austen, and my next article is going to be looking at how we analyze the corpus of Jane Austen's work digitally, and what are the benefits for literary criticism to move in that direction.
And Elizabeth Ricketts, let me ask you a question that you're not going to expect. Do you have a favorite Jane Austen movie? Because I hear a lot of debate about whether or not the movies actually are fair and live up to the quality of the books. Do you have a favorite film version of Jane Austen?
That's a really hard question, because there's also the adaptations like Bridget Jones's Diary. But if I have to stick to ones specifically that are based on Jane Austen, I do have to pick Sense and Sensibility. That's just a fantastic movie.
Well, Elizabeth Ricketts and Laura Runge and Frank Schulenberg, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate being able to talk to you. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you here. Well, you're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF in Tampa. Umika Thomas and Patty Perkey are our engineers behind the scenes. And in a moment, we're going to talk about the best restaurants here in the Tampa Bay area. Stick around. music from Oliver Mitikudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, the restaurant critic at the Tampa Bay Times has decided to go public. Usually, they stay pretty much quiet and keep their pictures out of the paper. Well, Laura Riley has gone public, and she's had her picture in the paper for the first time. So now, if you're a restaurant owner and you see her coming, you know to give her the best service. Laura Riley is also out with her list of the 50 best Tampa Bay restaurants, and we're going to talk about that next here on Radioactivity. Hi, Laura Riley. Welcome back to WMNF. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So you decided to go public. Why? Most restaurant critics prefer to remain anonymous.
Well, that's where you're wrong. So I actually did, for a conference that we had a couple years ago, I did a poll of all of my kind of brethren at the other papers around the country, and at this point, a little more than half of them are out. And I think there are a couple good reasons for that. I mean, some of it is just sheer capitulation in this time of, you know, social media and everyone walking around constantly with a camera in their hand. You know, it just gets harder and harder to keep your face off of Google, basically. But I think also part of it is just the changing nature of food writing. The classic, you know, every newspaper having someone whose full-time job was to do a thumbs up or thumbs down. That's just less the case. You know, most of us food writers are doing other kinds of writing and investigative work and kind of more unpacking the food system kind of stories. And it just gets harder to, or even agriculture stories. It's hard to do that if you're really hung up on people knowing what you look like.
Yeah, and you did that great series last year, Farm to Table, that exposed a bunch of restaurants here in the Tampa Bay area that claimed to be organic or locally sourced, and they weren't.
Exactly.
Yeah. How long have you been a restaurant critic?
27 years.
27 years.
Wait, 26 years, since 1991.
Is there a danger, though, that the getting back to this anonymity, is there a danger that the restaurant owner sees you coming and realizes they've got to put their best wait staff on your table and really let the chef know that when you're preparing, when the chef is preparing this dish, it's got to be, you know, bang up?
Sure. Well, Ruth Reichel did one of her most famous reviews when she was at the New York Times was of Le Cirque. And she went in once and they had no idea who she was. She went in another time. They knew it. And she really looked at what was happening at the tables around her, the portion sizes, the plate presentations, the level of service. And there was a massive discrepancy. But, you know, she wasn't oblivious to that, you know. And I think that that's a key to it is there are a handful of things a restaurant can do to make things different if they know that it's me. Mm-hmm. They can certainly make portions bigger, which isn't always a great thing in my book. I think American portion sizes are already kind of absurd. I'll probably get a better waiter, you know. But I will say, the night after I came out, I went to do a review meal and I thought, oh, I'm so busted today. Like, my face has been everywhere today. They had no clue.
Good.
So, yeah, it was. I think it's also, the truth is, a lot of people who work in restaurants, they're just doing their job. They're working really fast and hard, and they don't have time to worry about, you know, some little blonde lady in the corner who may be, you know, the food critic.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Laura Riley, the food critic at the Tampa Bay Times, is here, and she's also out with her list of Tampa Bay's top 50 restaurants. We're going to talk about the top 10 in just a moment. How do you decide which restaurants to review?
It's a kind of a strange Sudoku game, you know. It's geographically, I have a huge readership area to cover, so I have to kind of be reasonable. You know, a lot of the dynamism is happening downtown St. Pete and downtown Tampa, or, you know, South Tampa and Seminole Heights a little bit. But I really do have to make sure that I'm heading up to Clearwater or into Hernando County or Pasco. So some of it is a geographical thing that I'm trying to be, you know, fair-minded. And then I try to hit every price point and then pretty much every cuisine. So, you know, like if I've done and then new restaurants versus old restaurants. I mean, old restaurants shouldn't be penalized for having done something well for 20 years. So occasionally I have to go back and revisit places that I've visited before.
Do you ever go down to Manatee or Sarasota counties?
I do. A couple times a year I do something in Orlando. I do something in Sarasota, Bradenton area. You know, I'll do some kind of road trippy type things, mostly because I think our readership all spend a weekend, you know, on Anna Maria or those kinds of things. So I think it's a service to readers.
Now, before I ask you about your list of the best restaurants in the Bay Area, do you have a favorite hole-in-the-wall restaurant? Like, you know, cheapo hole-in-the-wall place that maybe doesn't get a lot of publicity?
Not really. I think some of my faves, I'm always a little bit trepidatious about putting them in the top 50 because it just means they're going to be busier for a while. So, places like Osteria Natalina, it's by my house, and I just love
his
food.
That's on South McDill in Tampa.
Yeah, it's one of my faves and someplace I go. I mean, I tend to, when I'm working, I review restaurants, and when I'm not reviewing restaurants, I cook. So there aren't that many times that I go out to eat just recreationally.
What do you notice the most about a restaurant when you're preparing to do a review about it?
Well, I think a lot of reviewing restaurants is figuring out intentionality. What is the restaurant intending to do? And you can tell a lot by signage, by what the menu looks like. I mean, physically, is it a laminated menu? Is it huge? Is it one of those heavy books with many pages? I mean, I think there are things like that kind of adjust your expectations as a diner. And obviously the food quality has to be good to get a good review, but there's so many other components. I mean, it's a thing of many moving parts, so they kind of all have to be firing at the same time.
In your article in the weekend section of the Tampa Bay Times this week, the weekend section, you say the next time Zagat or Food and Wine publishes a list of the country's best food destinations, Tampa Bay will be there. Charleston, South Carolina, Seattle, Denver, and Richmond have had their day in the sun, and for good reason, but the stars have aligned for us, and we're really ready for our close-up, you say.
I think I'm going to sound like such a Pollyanna right now, and I'm not just being like some kind of, visit Tampa Bay booster type person, but I really think, especially, the January, I always look back. I spend a lot of time thinking about where we were a year ago and where we've kind of moved, and it really does seem like a lot of things have come together at the same time to make us a much stronger food region than we were even just a couple years ago. I think, and I do credit craft beer with a lot of that was kind
Why
of
craft
a,
beer? Why?
Well, craft beer often gets, younger people in particular interested in food, for whatever reason, people kind of get an enthusiasm for craft beer and what goes with good beer, but good food. So I think it's gotten a lot of people interested in other types of artisanal food businesses, and we've seen a real influx of millennials going away to college and then moving back to the Tampa Bay area and starting businesses that are food related. And I think that's been a big component to what has made it a really robust couple of years in terms of growth.
I don't know if there's any way to measure this, but I've heard often that millennials are foodies.
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, the irony is that a lot of them don't know how to cook at all. If you said roast a chicken, they would be totally flummoxed, but they are foodies. I mean, I have a 22-year-old, and all of her friends, they can tell you from age 10, could tell you a good pad thai from a bad pad thai, or chicken, lamb vindaloo. I think it's an interesting generation, and I do actually think they care about the story behind their food. I think they do tend to patronize independent restaurants and restaurants that have a story that they can feel kind of morally content with.
Laura Riley is here. She's the food critic at the Tampa Bay Times. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address, if you want to send an email comment in or question, send it to dj@wmnf.org. So I've got the list from the weekend section of the Tampa Bay Times. And I'll just read the, I'm going to read 2 through 10, if that's
Sounds
okay. Do you have your
me.
List in front of you?
I do.
Okay, so let me have you read the best restaurants in Tampa Bay. We're not going to name number one right now, but 2 through 10, what are
Creating
they?
Creating a little drama, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So my number 2 this year was the Reading Room in St. Pete. You been there?
No. Is that on Central Avenue?
It's on Central, but way away from downtown. So it's kind of near where Freefall Theater is.
And was it started by the Freefall people?
It was. So the two gentlemen who have Freefall are the owners, and they brought in a chef and her partner from Asheville, North Carolina. And they're really doing kind of, I know the farm to fork, farm to table is so overused, but it is that kind of food, that kind of new American, fairly simply plated, very veggie forward, and they have a 3,500 square foot garden out front. So it's a pretty, so I think they lament sometimes that they aren't right downtown, but there's no way they could have that component of it if they were right downtown.
I should say that all these restaurants too, some are expensive, some are moderate, and some are very affordable.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, so I think that's also been an interesting thing. I think 10 years ago, any list of best restaurants in the Tampa Bay area would have all been fine dining, all white tablecloth. And I think that what makes a great food region is quality food, food that pushes the envelope at every price point.
Now, number three is?
Farm Table Cucina. So that's the second floor of Local Market, Michael Mina. And they reconcepted this year and went from kind of a, I guess, Cal-Med, Ital-type medley cuisine to a straight-up Italian. And Jeffrey Hallman, the chef, is not Italian. And I thought, how's this going to work? Why are they doing this? Why are they making this change? So I was a little bit skeptical. And it just knocked my socks off. They are really doing great work. I mean, it's been a good restaurant since it debuted. But I think that for whatever reason, they're just doing remarkably well right now.
All right. Number four is?
Number four, we have Noble Rice. And this is one that kind of snuck up on me. It opened on Platt Street, I think maybe a year ago.
This is in Hyde Park in Tampa?
In Hyde Park, but kind of a little near where Boca is, a little bit off the beaten path. And I'd heard about it from a couple people and thought, oh, it was a new sushi restaurant, whatever. And it is just remarkable. And Eric, the owner, is bringing in his fish from Japan. You know, really the only person in this area to source fish at that level. And there's a kind of a clean, kind of pure, very Japanese aesthetic to what he's doing there. But it also has kind of a funk factor, the restaurant itself. So definitely a find, maybe not for everyone, you know, but there are dishes there that will just, you know, blow your mind, but with simplicity.
That's just around the corner from where M&F started at 305 South Boulevard.
Oh,
but
really?
They're on West Platt Street. That's Noble Rice, number four. Number five?
Il Ritorno. So David Benstock did a James Beard dinner this year and had a huge renovation and kind of doubled the size of the restaurant and really reopened in December. And I went and sat at the new, it's an open kitchen with a kitchen bar, and I sat there and watched him put together a meal a few weeks ago. And he is such a talent, and we are so lucky to have him.
This is a great Italian restaurant on Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg, and everything is made to order.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they really have stepped up their service. The general manager there is incredible wine knowledge, came from the Modern in New York. And it's just, I think that they've moved dramatically forward with this renovation.
Number six?
Number six is Edison, a place that's been on my list pretty much every year since it opened. You know, and Jeannie Parola is also, you know, one of our superstars. And I think what I really love about her food is that it tells such a Florida story. It's such a kind of homage to, you know, Florida ingredients and kind of Florida history. There's, you know, a lot of kind of Cuban Caribbean influence in what she does over there. I never have a bad time. I think it's one of those restaurants where I just tend to always have fun.
Is a sign of, as we go through these restaurants, is a sign of a good restaurant that they change their menu frequently? Is that
I
always
would say,
a sign?
I think, you know, some of my longtime readers have said, well, why aren't some of the classics, you know, Burns, Columbia, on the list? And I would say that, yeah, there's a certain kind of stasis to restaurants that have been around a long time. And part of that is because when you're a beloved restaurant, it's really hard to make dramatic change. You know, people don't like change.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a particular dish at the Columbia, you want that exact dish. And if Richard and his crew try to move things in this kind of, you know, in a much more contemporary vein, there's a, you know, backdraft. So I think that is something, you know, I feel like any kind of artistry, you have to have, you can work in an idiom for a while and then you got to move on and find something new. And I think that holds true absolutely for food.
I guess that's why Richard opens up new restaurants. Richard Gonsmart,
yeah, sure.
At the Columbia.
He's got more on the horizon.
Yeah, number seven.
So Brick and Mortar, that's another kind of small...
Not too far from Il Ritorno.
Yeah, I think it was in the same block. But they started as caterers, and they decided to take the plunge and go Brick and Mortar a couple years ago. And it's a fairly modest-looking place, really charming, but not fancy in any way. And they just do super ambitious food, I think, at a price point most of us could afford on a Tuesday night just because there's nothing in the fridge, you know? It's that kind of restaurant. But also there's a real warmth to the place. It feels like a place you want to hang out.
Number eight is really tucked away. Number eight is in one of these spots that is always talked about as an up-and-coming spot in Tampa.
Chena. So I have a feeling that Channel Side, you know, that Channel District area is obviously going to experience dramatic growth soon. I hope it doesn't adversely affect them. I don't know what's going to happen because I think their building's kind of going up on either side of that.
I think the new Publix is going
Central.
In somewhere around there.
Yes,
too. Yeah.
Indeed. Well, Michael is the chef over there, and it's very kind of classic Italian but personal. And really, risotto is his, wheelhouse. And I think that it's been, and his, oh, also desserts. Evan, his pastry chef, is just remarkable. And it's the kind of dessert that gets set down in front of you and everybody kind of pauses and gasps a little bit. You know, there's always kind of strange. It looks like a Lego construction or something often.
And number nine.
So this is a brand new one, and I kind of hesitated. Does a brand new restaurant deserve to be on this list? But it's a seasoned operator. So I said, I'm going with it. So Ichikoro Ane opened in Station House, I think in December.
This is in St. Pete.
In St. Pete. Yeah. So First Avenue South. And so it's a sister restaurant to Ichikoro in Seminole Heights, but a much larger, much more ambitious project. And so they're doing ramen as they do in the Seminole Heights location.
The Seminole Heights restaurant is elbow to elbow whenever I go in.
Absolutely.
There. Yeah. I mean, it's packed. It's, but is there a lot of space in the new one?
Tons of space, but right now it's filled with bodies. But no, they're doing great stuff and lots
who knew that a noodle house would make it here in the Tampa Bay
Area?
Oh,
I did. I've been
you
saying
did?
For years.
It's
people
so
have said,
hot,
what do we need here? No, a ramen is such a phenomenon. You know, it's this very kind of sensual, personal experience. And, you slurp it down in 10 minutes. And, so it's actually, you can have a pretty high volume. I hear that the ramen, the noodle soup table at the Seminole Hard Rock is one of the highest grossing per seat restaurants in the country. Uh-huh. And that's because you get in, you get out in 10 minutes,
right,
and that table turns all day long and night. So.
And number 10.
Well, and this is one of my faves. So Pizzeria Gregorio, I bet you Gregory is listening right now. I people are saying to me, what pizzeria on the top 10? What's that? And I think that to me, what he does over there is he's always pushing forward, always kind of refining and tweaking. And, he's a perfectionist. And I think that if you bring that to bear on any cuisine, you deserve to be considered, at the pinnacle of what you do. And I think he's remarkable.
Talk about locally sourced. That
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, he does not fool around. I mean, this is a guy who I think he has eaten asparagus at this point because he found somewhere in Florida that was growing it. But he really, really eats local.
Number 10, Pizzeria Gregorio. All right, so let's back up. And what is the number one restaurant in your top 50 this year?
So for this year, and this has been on my list pretty much every year since they opened, but Rooster in the Till. And this is a restaurant that had expanded a couple years ago, and I was kind of nervous. Oh, it's so charming and intimate. If it doubles in size, is it going to have the same feel? And they did really maintain it. And I think that Farrell Alvarez has had a tremendous year. 2017 was really good for him. And he had this guest chef series, which I think was very reinvigorating. I think that a lot of chefs are a little bit siloed in their restaurants. They don't have a lot of opportunity to interact with their peers in other cities. And so a guest chef series is one. I mean, that's why they all go to festivals,
right.
these big, food and wine festivals. But a guest chef series is a way to learn new tricks, to kind of talk about the dialogue, what's going on, what's cutting edge right now, to rethink some of your kind of staple items. And I think he's really done that this
year. What's one of your favorite things on the menu at the Rooster and the Till there in Seminole Heights?
They're always changing, so it's really hard to say. I mean, I've liked his pork belly. He's had that on the menu for a long, long time. I tend to really like his vegetables. He had a broccoli dish that had kind of a burnt toast smear on the bottom of the plate. And I know that doesn't sound delicious, but it was amazing. And then he does a lot of things where he'll puff rice or he'll puff farro or some kind of grain. So there's real good textural interest in a dish, but I think his vegetables really shine to me.
Well, Laura Riley is here. She's the food critic at the Tampa Bay Times. She's just out with her list of the top 50 restaurants here in the Tampa Bay area, and she also does investigative reporting. Before we go to the phones, I want to ask you a quick question. You did a story a few weeks ago about a robotic strawberry picker that they're developing in Eastern Hillsborough County. How close is that robot to replacing humans, do you think?
Well, they're in beta testing now. I think it will happen. Obviously, there's a big R&D budget that will have to get, you know, amortized over the first couple of years of the launch. But I think that every farmer I've talked to in Florida and in California say it's an inevitability, that we just do not have enough farm workers. We don't have a reliable you know, that migrant workers are just not as plentiful as they were even 10 years ago. And some of that is about the demographics in Mexico. Yeah. And I think
and some
that,
of it's about the politics, the political atmosphere
sure,
here in
sure,
the US.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. It's immigration policy. It's but I think a lot of it is that the birth rate in Mexico, which has historically been where we've gotten a lot of our farm workers, has dramatically dipped, you know, where 40 years ago it was 6.1 per person, per, you know, mother. And now it's the same as the U.S., basically, a little over two. And also Mexico's a huge producer of food now. So they keep a lot of their farm workers there.
Yeah, workers are there, yeah.
So I think that we're definitely going to see that. There are certain crops that lend themselves to machine picking or robotic picking. And there are interesting things that a robot can do that a human can't do. Like these the strawberry picking in particular, the robot has a GPS that can identify what particular fruits will be ripe 2 days from now or 3 days from now, and they can cut that machine can come back to precisely that spot. So there are ways that the machine brain is more effective.
Laura Riley is here. She's the food critic at the Tampa Bay Times. Let's go to David, who's in Pasco County. Hi, David. You're on the air. What's your question for Laura?
Well, I like she mentioned Pizzeria Gregario, and that is in Safety Harbor, if I'm not mistaken.
It sure is.
They open at 4:00, and that's the only thing that's kept me from going there. Every time I seem to go through McMullen Booth Road or Safety Harbor, and I do miss the old K-pop tree, but I always think about Pizzeria Gregario, but somehow going to dinner at 4:00 or a late lunch just doesn't work for me. I'm always in there noonish or 1:00. I want to ask you about Clearwater Beach. One of my favorites has always been Hylam and Beachcomber, and I remember my parents, my uncles, and I going there back in the 60s. And they're famous for their relish tray, but it seems kind of archaic. But right next door is Bobby's Bistro, and I will tell you that... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're still on.
I was going to say that a lot of the places I go to for a burger now, you're going to pay $10, $11, $12 for a decent burger, but I think that Bobby's Bistro, for $8.95, they have one of the finest hamburgers that I've ever had in my life.
Well, thanks for that. Yeah, so I actually, Heilman's Beachcomber was on my list of 50 this year. I had a couple good experiences there the end of November, I think. And Bobby's Bistro has that tremendous Pinot Noir wine list, right? Are you a Pinot drinker?
No. I'm more of a craft beer drinker.
Well, I will check out their burger, definitely.
Well, I tell you, for $8.95, and the service the first night was eclectic. The service could have been better the second night, but my server the first night, they came out with the most delicious bread that had extra virgin olive oil with herbs and spices, and it was just eclectic in itself, and a nice salad. And to find a burger for $8.95, I just came back from St. Augustine Beach, and some of the nicer restaurants are over there are charging $10.95, $11.95 for a run-of-the-mill burger. So I think Bobby's Bistro is high up on my list. And I just wonder, could you recommend anything in the West Pasco area? I have trouble finding a decent restaurant in West Pasco, and I find myself going to Tarpon Springs most of the time, especially Rusty Belly's for shrimp.
Yeah, no, that Rusty Belly's is good. So West Pasco, which is there a community in particular that you're interested in?
Anywhere from Holiday to Hudson. It's like a dead zone.
It is a little bit of a dead zone. I hate to say that. That's you know, terribly snobby of me.
There's a lot of chain restaurants there.
Yeah, it's just not a super fertile area. I mean, I tend to not find things that are reviewable in that area.
Yeah. All right, David.
I tend to go to Rusty Belly's, but I tell you what, anybody wants a decent burger for $8.95,
okay,
their price has changed. Bobby's Beef.
All right. Well, David, thanks. And Bobby's thanks you, too, for calling in. Yeah, a good advertisement for him. Let's go to Lee in St. Pete. Hi, Lee. You're on. What's your question for Laura?
Hey, Laura. What I'm sorry to be so ignorant. Where do I get that list of your top list of 50 restaurants?
Well, it was in the paper. It was a pullout section in the paper yesterday. But online, you can just go to tampabay.com. And I think it's still on the homepage today and probably should be for a while.
Okay.
And it's interactive, so you can sort by whatever's important to you, pet friendly, kid friendly, or you can do it geographically if you are looking in from a particular area. And on your phone, I think that's a nice component of it that you can kind of figure out where you are right now and what's closest.
All right,
that's awesome. One more question is, what do you think about Boca?
I've had a lot of good meals at Boca. I had some concerns about them last year when I did my Farm to Fable expose. And I don't know about their practices now, but I have enjoyed meals at the one in South Tampa, definitely.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, Lee, thanks a lot. Now, Suzanne writes, I didn't see the article in the paper. Were there any vegan restaurants? There are now 22 million vegans living in the U.S., I was in Salt Lake City, where four new vegan vegetarian restaurants just opened up. Tampa's so far behind the rest of the U.S. Thank goodness for St. Pete, where they embrace veganism better.
So I will say there are zero vegan restaurants on this list this year. But
now, what do you think of Cider House on Central Avenue?
I think it's good. I think it's a little pricey. I think that there have been many lunches I've had there that I walk away still a little bit hungry, and I've spent $20. And that's the nature of raw and vegan food. It's labor intensive to make, and especially when you're talking about green juice, it's a lot of product that goes into that juice. Yeah. I would say that almost all of the restaurants that are on this list, I would say maybe 40 out of the 50, have really made an effort in the past couple of years to offer vegan and vegetarian entrees. Remember the bad old days where the bottom said something like, our chef can make you something vegetarian. It's like, well, no, I don't want some ad hoc thing that you've thrown together. I want an actually conceived dish that you've thought through. Mm-hmm. And I don't want just the side dishes heaped onto a plate. So I think that almost all the restaurants that I've written about this past year, I think that's been a notable change, that there are, and often they're indicated on the menu with with an icon or something that says vegan or vegetarian.
I got to say it, I'm not a food critic, but I've had the vegan burger at Cider House. Outstanding.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So, Rob, have you tried that new Impossible Burger?
No, I haven't. Tell me about it. Have you tried it?
Yes. It's excellent.
Is it?
Yeah, it's really good. So Chichio, the restaurant group is the first one to bring that in here in the Tampa Bay area. It's a incredible Silicon Valley, designed hamburger, essentially, that's made out of all vegetable matter. And, it's not, I would say it's 95% convincing, and gives that kind of tooth resistance and the kind of the real feel of a hamburger. And if, I guess we all eat, I don't remember, 5 burgers a week or something on average. It's a ridiculous number of hamburgers that Americans eat. If we all switch one of those to a vegan burger, I think, the world would be a little bit better.
Yeah, less food or less water used in food production, whole lot of benefits, and fewer cows on the planet.
Sure.
Let's go to Richard in St. Petersburg. Hi, Richard. You're on. What's your question for Laura?
Well, actually, first I'd like to thank her and the Times staff for the Farm to Table, because that did enlighten a lot of people. And I also really appreciate the fact that she has been so inclusive, that you've been so inclusive about getting into the smaller hole in the walls and crossing the line between the legacy type and all type of food genres. It's very impressive. Actually, I've gone to a few that you've recommended, and very rarely walk away going, kinda. But I do have one question for you. You always see all the little mom-and-pop convenience places, Best Cuban, whatever. Have you considered doing some type of comparison along those lines with the mom-and-pops? And I'll hang up so the next caller can get on.
All right. Thanks, Richard.
That's a great idea, Richard. Actually, I love those kind of stories, kind of roundup stories. I was thinking recently I might do a roundup, a walking tour of Armenia, of all the little ethnic restaurants on Armenia.
All the Latin restaurants,
I mean, people love the stories where you do the top 10 Cubans. I think that because it's an opportunity for everybody to say how wrong I got it. But thanks for the suggestion.
All right, let's do just a quick round, very short answers. Are you familiar with Piccolo Italian Bistro on MLK?
I am. I went there early on when all the Yelp hubbub occurred with it. It's super charming. My question was, how on earth is this guy making any money? So it was $10 pastas, no liquor license, no corkage fee, so you could bring in what you want. It was very limited. When I went, it was very limited in terms of appetizers and desserts. So it was pastas.
And this is MLK in St. Pete or in Tampa?
In Tampa.
Okay.
I think the guy who owns it is an Italian who is married to a woman who is assistant faculty at USF. And so he didn't want to work for someone else and decided to kind of go it on his own. He can't have a liquor license because it's right next to a preschool.
Oh, boy. So, Laura, we're out of time. People can see your list at
TampaBay.com.
Laura Riley, thank you so much for coming by. I wish we had more time.
All right, next time.
All right, next time we'll have to have you back. Dan Ruth is coming up next. I'm Rob Lori. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back Monday morning. This is WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for Midpoint with Daniel.